Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks for hanging with us. We continue with Ask Me Anything of the Internet variety. We've got tons of questions that come to us from the Internet, and we're trying to get to as many of them as possible. And the guy to do that with is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, author of a whole bunch of great books, including The Bible is a Catholic Book and A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and many, many more. Jimmy, thanks for coming back for another hour.
My pleasure.
Let's get right back to the questions, because we really do have a lot of questions. And this one comes from Giacomo Cutton, 5630. And Giacomo wants to know this. Is it possible that God punishes my continuous sin through my son's disease?
Okay. So anytime anyone asks a question of the form, is it possible that X occurs, the answer is going to be yes, it's possible, given that God is omnipotent and can thus do what he chooses. But that's a separate question than is it likely that that's what's happening. And what we're told, especially in the New Testament, is that God is love. And so, and that includes both love for you and love for your son. And the way almost all theologians today would look at this question would be to say that your sin and your son's disease should be understood to be independent of each other, that God's not going to cause your son to suffer because you're doing something bad. Now, you shouldn't do the thing that's bad, and you should take steps to address that. Depending on the nature of the sin, it may or may not be something that's easy to cut off, and God understands if it's not easy to cut off. You know, the habitual sins are not things that people are responsible for in the way that a purely voluntary sin is. But God is a loving God, and you shouldn't understand him as causing your son to suffer in order to punish you for a sin. One of the things that is emphasized in, for example, it's actually emphasized in both Jeremiah and Ezekiel, but one of the things that's emphasized in those books is that this is that God does not, God holds the people who are responsible accountable and not others. There was apparently a saying at the time of the Babylonian exile of the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth have been set on edge, meaning the fathers have done something that they're responsible for, but then the consequence of that, the harm, falls on the children. And through Jeremiah and Ezekiel, God said, stop saying that. That's not the way it's going to be. It's going to be the person who does something bad, that's the person that's going to be held accountable, not their offspring. And so even though there may have been an earlier stage of development in Israel's history where this was not clear, God made it clear at this time. And so you should not understand your son's disease as connected to something that you're doing. You should still do your best to, you know, avoid this sin, to cut it off and so forth. But you shouldn't blame yourself for what's happening with your son.
Oh, okay. Giacomo, I hope that that was helpful to you. Thank you very much for the question. Questions, all the questions from the internet today. This is from Philip325. Can a Catholic hold the Genesis gap theory, or is it heretical?
Okay, so first we should explain what the gap theory is. It's also sometimes called the ruin and restitution theory. This is a theory that was proposed in the 19th century and the 20th century as a way of trying to square Genesis 1 with what science was discovering about the age of the earth and the cosmos. And what it does is it puts a gap, that's why it's called the gap theory, between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. So if you read those two verses together, it goes like this. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. So that second verse about the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, that describes the condition of the earth when they were made. So in the beginning, God created them, and this is what they were like. And then over the rest of Genesis 1, he solves the problems of them being formless and empty by first giving the different areas of creation form. He separates day from night. He separates sky from sea, and he separates the seas so that dry land appears. And then in the second 3 days of creation, he goes back over those same three realms and populates them so they're no longer empty. So on day four, he goes back to the day and the night and populates those with the sun, moon, and stars. On day five, he goes back to the sky and the sea and populates them with birds and fish. And on day six, he goes back to the land and populates that with the land, animals, and man. So that's the classic way of reading this passage. But what gap theorists do is they say, well, no, that's not the way it works. And there's a big jump in time between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. So the way they understand it, Genesis 1:1 says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Okay, fine. But then there's this enormous gap of time, and they'll commonly translate verse 2 not as the earth was without form and void, but the earth became formless and void. And then God repairs the formlessness and voidness over the next 6 days. And they'll often link the earth becoming formless and void to the fall of the angels and say that that's what ruined creation. And then God restores creation on the 6 days recorded in Genesis 1. So that's why it's also called the ruin restoration theory. And this allows you potentially to shove millions or billions of years into the gap between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2, and thus try to interpret the passage in a way that is consistent with the findings of modern science. So the first thing, or one of the things Philip asks, he says, can a Catholic hold the Genesis gap theory, or is it heretical? Well, it's definitely not heretical. The church has never defined infallibly that it has been divinely revealed that the gap theory is false. In fact, the church doesn't comment on the gap theory one way or another. So I would say a Catholic can, from a legal point of view, hold the gap theory, but that doesn't mean you should hold the gap theory. There are problems with it, and the problems occur on two fronts. The first front is exegetical. Because the Hebrew grammar, even though gap theorists will try to argue this, the Hebrew grammar actually does not support and does not even permit the gap theory. There is a construction in Hebrew that is very frequently omitted in English. They tend to begin sentences with a vav, which is the Hebrew letter that corresponds to the v. To say it as a word, okay, that corresponds to the English and. And so there is a vav at the beginning of the second sentence. And it's a particular usage of the v that would not permit you to translate verse 2 as the earth became formless and void. So just exegetically, the gap theory is ruled out on grammatical grounds. The second problem with the gap theory is it doesn't really solve the problem you want it to, because even though hypothetically you could shove millions or billions of years into this chronology, that is not going to change the fact that if you take everything else literally, you're going to have God repairing the universe and creating man and land animals and birds and fish and sun, moon, and stars in a 6-day period that happened about 6,000 years ago. And that is not what the scientific evidence indicates happened. So it's both grammatically impossible, and it doesn't solve your problem with science anyway, because science still contradicts the gap theory. So for both of those reasons, I don't think that the gap theory is successful. The way Genesis presents creation is as a series of 6 24-hour days. And the question is, should that be taken literally, or should it be taken figuratively? And the approach that the Catechism takes, and thus that the Church takes, is that it should be understood as a symbolic succession of 6 days. So these aren't literal days, but they do present the acts of the Creator using the literary framework of the Hebrew week.
Got it. All right. Thank you. I hadn't, you know what? The gap theory was new to me. So the Genesis gap theory, I should say. Philip, thank you very much for the question. We'll take a quick break. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it's an Ask Me Anything of the Internet variety. Continuing with that right after this.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The power of prayer simply means that words have an effect. For example, when a couple says, "I do," it literally changes two people to becoming one in marriage. When you say, "I love you," it changes us and it gives us value. The power of prayer is in the words and in the sentiment, but it's also in the fact that God, who is omnipotent, all-powerful, answers our prayers.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's Ask Me Anything this hour with Jimmy Akin. And all the questions are in because it's an internet Ask Me Anything. And the next one comes from Divine Mercy Catechesis. Probably not the person's baptismal name. But Divine Mercy Catechesis wants to know this. How can the Church evangelize those with disabilities? What are good resources that can help me get started?
Well, the Church can evangelize those with disabilities the same way the Church evangelizes everybody, by preaching the gospel. Now, depending on the disability in question, that may have to take different forms. You know, if you're trying to evangelize a deaf person, you can't use spoken language to do that, at least not presently. Although, in the future, we'll have better speech-to-text technology. So someone could be talking in spoken language and it could be translating it into text or sign or something like that to make it easier for a deaf person to perceive. We're not quite there yet with that technology. If someone is blind, obviously you're not going to be able to use standard printed materials as part of evangelization, though there are things like Braille. And there are finger scanners that can translate written text into Braille so someone can use a written text and read it. So these are technological possibilities. But the principal effort of evangelization doesn't fall on the Church per se, because the Church is an abstract entity. It falls on individual members of the Church. And it falls principally on bishops and priests, and they do need to evangelize, but they have a lot of other duties too, besides just evangelization. And so for that reason, the principle, in terms of practice, the principal burden of evangelization often falls on the laity. And that's why it's good that Divine Mercy Catechesis says, what are good resources that can help me get started? Well, So I'm sure there, and here I don't have specific resources to recommend, but I know there are ministries in the Catholic Church that focus on different groups with disabilities, and you can just use, you know, Google to find them. Particularly, there may be some in your area, or you may be able to start some in your area. But I would say I would give a couple of guiding principles. One, obviously, you need to know how to evangelize in general, and two, you need to think about what kind of people with disabilities you're interested in evangelizing, because it's not going to be the same for everybody. Someone who is blind has different needs than someone who is deaf, and someone who is deaf has different needs than someone who has cerebral palsy, and someone with cerebral palsy has different needs than someone who just has mobility issues that make it hard to get to church. So you need to think about, what kind of disabled people am I trying to help? And then research the disability and research ways to overcome it. Then you'll be in a position to reach out and help these people. If someone, you know, just can't drive a car, you could say, hey, you know, for whatever reason, you could say, hey, would you like to come to church with me? I'd be happy to drive you. Or, you know, maybe we can set up a bus at my church to go around and help bring people to church who otherwise would have difficulty getting there. You can use computer technology to help discuss the gospel with people with disabilities. When I was a kid, I had a cousin who was deaf, and when I was a kid, he had a kind of prototype device that was kind of like a modem. Basically, you could type on a keyboard, and it would transmit what you typed over the phone lines, and then type it on a machine that he had, and we could use keyboards to send messages back and forth over the phone lines. Well, that was a new and novel technology back then, but today everybody has that and more as part of the internet. So there are a lot of advantages that the internet in particular, and smartphones and computers and things like that, have that can make it easier to help people with different disabilities participate in social communication and things like that. And from that point, it's simply a matter of sharing stuff. Now, there are also cultural sensitivities that one needs to learn about. For example, Divine Mercy Catechesis used the phrase disability. Well, that's a sensitive term for some people who deal with some of these limitations. For example, in deaf culture, there is a, this is not universal, but among many deaf people, there is a desire to not so much focus on deafness as a disability, but as a culture, because of the unique things that deaf people need to do to communicate, it ends up creating a separate culture. And you don't have to be deaf to be part of that culture. You just need to know how to communicate with deaf people. But as part of learning about the disability, you're going to want to learn about, are there particular cultural sensitivities I need to be aware of so that I don't sabotage my evangelization efforts by, you know, accidentally tripping over these. So I would say the first step is identify the kind of people you want to help, and then research the type, research the disability in question, including how to overcome difficulties and how to avoid creating problems, and then just use the tools that are available to do this. And many of these will have already been explored by different groups. Even if they're not in your area, if you can find, you know, just using Google, a group that ministers to deaf people or blind people or people with cerebral palsy or whatever it may be, and learn from them how they do it, then you can apply those own principles in your area. So that's how I'd suggest going about getting started in this ministry.
Divine Mercy Catechesis, thank you for the question. Jimmy Akin, our guest. All the questions in already from the internet. This one comes from Maddie9869. Can we, in good conscience, support the death penalty? I can't seem to understand why the church changed this. In theory, can't the church's teaching on this revert?
Okay, so to answer these questions, I need to kind of sketch the different levels of authority that church teachings can have. And this is something I discuss at length in my book, Teaching with Authority. So for more information, I'd suggest you get a copy of that. But basically, the church documents contain statements of different levels of authority. At the top are dogmas. Dogmas are not just infallible teachings. They're things that the church has infallibly taught to be divinely revealed. A step down from that, there are other infallible teachings, which are indeed infallible. They're guaranteed to be true, but the church hasn't infallibly taught that they are part of divine revelation. They may be something else that we know to be true for other reasons, not simply because it's part of revelation. Below that, we have other doctrines, and these can have a variety of levels of authority from extremely strong to very tentative. And then below doctrines, there are things that are said in passing that are sort of matters of opinion or applications of doctrine, but they're not properly doctrine themselves. So that's kind of the spectrum of different levels of authority. So where does the church's current position on the death penalty go in that spectrum? Well, what the current edition of the Catechism says is that the death penalty is inadmissible. And it then appeals to some doctrinal considerations for that have to do with human dignity and so forth. Historically, the church has acknowledged that the death penalty is legitimate in principle. And when Pope Francis revised the Catechism, this language of inadmissibility got used. And that's unexpected because this is not an established way of talking about matters. It didn't say, for example, that the death penalty is intrinsically immoral, meaning it can never be done. Inadmissible is clearly a term that means I don't want you doing this, but it's not the same thing as saying this can never be done. And it would be the logical explanation for this is they deliberately picked inadmissible because they didn't want to contradict previous church teaching that it is in principle legitimate in at least some circumstances that may have applied historically, even if you don't think they apply today. So mm-hmm. I think there's some deliberate vagueness there that would allow people to say, well, you know, it's legitimate in principle in some circumstances. It's just it may not be legitimate in terms of actual application given present conditions. On the other hand, the present formulation is also consistent with a position of saying, no, it was always wrong to use the death penalty. That's just harder to justify from a traditional Catholic perspective. With having said all that, there's also, I should mention, another way of looking at what the current formulation is, which would be to say that really the statement that it's inadmissible is not itself a doctrine, but is an application to present circumstances of doctrinal principles. And in that case, the current formulation would not itself be a teaching that one would be bound to observe. You would be, in principle, bound to observe the doctrinal principles behind that, but you might be able to disagree with the application to present situations. On the other hand, if you say, no, this is a doctrinal formulation, then it is something we're in principle bound to believe, but it's very tentative. It's down on the lowest level of the doctrine. Mm-hmm. So it's nowhere close to infallible, to being infallible or being a dogma. And given that, since it falls into this realm of non-infallible teachings, it is possible, in principle, to disagree with it. This is something that the church has acknowledged for a long time, that if something's not infallible, well, it's not guaranteed to be true. And consequently, the church recognizes that in exceptional circumstances, it's possible for a theologian or a layperson to say, you know, I just can't agree with this non-infallible teaching. Now, there are conditions on that. Like, you need to recognize the Holy Spirit guides the church in the overall exercise of its ministry. So you don't just presume that that a non-infallible teaching is mistaken, and you need to give open-minded consideration to it, and you need to not publicly dissent from it, you know, not go out and start a rah-rah death penalty movement with people in the public. Discussing it among scholars is a different situation, but it is possible for non-infallible teachings to have elements in them that are mistaken, and that would include this one. This is something that's discussed in a 1990 document the then Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith put out called Dona Veritatis. And I also discuss it in Teaching with Authority. So in answering the question, can we in good conscience support the death penalty? Yes, but there are qualifications there. In theory, can the church's teaching on this revert? In principle, yes, because it's not infallible, but that doesn't mean either one of the questions that have been asked are easy.
Maddie, thank you so much. Quick break, right back with more Ask Me Anything of the Internet Variety with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Do you have what it takes to defend your Catholic faith? The work of apologetics takes study, practice, and skill, but more than anything, it takes spiritual strength. The Soul of Apologetics, a new prayer resource from Catholic Answers, gives you the spiritual tools every Catholic apologist needs: prayers, meditations, and scripture-based reflections to build up the interior life. Order your copy of The Soul of Apologetics today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world. But it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Welcome back. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Lots of questions from the internet this hour. Next one comes from SYoung165. S. Young wants to know this. Is there a miraculous quality to St. Paul recovering from the stoning at Lystra or from all the other beatings he suffered? It seems any number of the rods, stonings, etc. could have disabled him and made his long-distance travels impossible.
Well, I think this is a matter people can have different opinions on. Now, partly it's going to depend on how you understand a miracle. Sometimes people would say a miracle is anything that God does in the world. And if that's how you define miracle, then I think St. Paul would say, oh, yeah, there are miracles associated with how God got me through these different trials and physical stresses and things like that. And he continues to guide my ministry and make my travel possible. I couldn't do it without God. But that's not how most folks use the term miracle. Normally, when they use the term miracle, they use it to refer to something. The original word, it comes from miraculum, which means something to wonder at. It's something that causes amazement. And certainly, Paul's ability to persevere, despite the trials he faced, is something that is very amazing, you know. But most of the time when people use the term miracle, they use it to refer to something where God intervenes in the world in a way that is so extraordinary, it makes it clear that it's God doing it, such as by separating, you know, the waters of the Red Sea or something, at a particular moment when they need to be separated. That's, even though there are wind phenomena, it's called a wind set down. And even though Exodus says God sent a wind that blew back the waters, the suggestion he used a wind set down to part the Red Sea, the fact it happened at this precise moment when the Israelites needed it, so it makes it clearer that this is God intervening in history. So the question would then become, can we show, not just from a faith perspective, that God was guiding Paul and helping Paul and stuff like that, but could we show to a skeptic that what happened with Paul is so extraordinary that the most logical explanation is that God intervened in the world from outside of history? And here I would say, not without more data. We have some descriptions of the things that happened to St. Paul, principally in 2 Corinthians. He gives a list of them, and there's additionally some information in the book of Acts that deal with them. And they do indicate things like he was stoned, or he was beaten with rods. He received the 39 lashes minus, or the 40 lashes minus one that Jewish law permitted, and things like that. But people can survive those without God miraculously intervening. And so I think a skeptic would say, you know, I don't see compelling evidence for a miracle or a group of miracles here. Now, if we had videotape and medical evaluations of Paul, we might find, you know, that something beyond what the normal course of nature would allow did happen. But we don't have videotape, and we don't have medical evaluations of St. Paul after these different events. So I would say there's enough ambiguity that we don't have the data we would need to show something beyond the normal course of nature here. And, you know, you could have someone else who wasn't St. Paul, who was just a very determined person, that might go through all the same experiences and still survive and still be able to travel.
All right. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. That was S. Young that asked that question. Thank you, S. Young. Next question comes from Pilgrim of the Tiber. Pilgrim wants to know, how does setting a prayer intention before praying a rosary differ from just praying for that intention directly without praying the rosary? Does it have something to do with the merit involved with praying a rosary? Thank you.
Okay. Well, the difference between setting a prayer intention and praying about that and setting an intention and praying the rosary about it is that in the latter case, you're praying a rosary. That's what the difference is. Now, I think that what Pilgrim of the Tiber may be asking under the surface question is, does praying the rosary give some additional advantage beyond just, say, directly praying to God about your intention? And the answer would be not in principle. I mean, you don't have to ask. You don't have to ask Mary, much less pray the Marian Rosary, for God to grant your request. God knows what you, as Jesus says, God knows what you need even before you ask Him. So it is sufficient to just pray to God and say, "Here's what I have a need for. Can you please help me with this?" But it's also God's will that we pray for each other. And so He's chosen to make the reception of certain benefits conditional on Christians praying for each other. And He wants us to honor Jesus's mother, as Mary herself says in the beginning of Luke's gospel, behold, now all generations will call me blessed, and we're part of all generations. So God wants us to call her blessed. So it, you know, he wants us to have a devotion to her. And one form that's taken in the most recent 1,000 years in the Latin West has been the Marian Rosary. So it's a good thing to pray the Marian Rosary to involve Mary and as a sign of one's devotion to Mary. And that adds something to just praying to God for your own. But it's not something that's necessary. And we shouldn't think of the rosary as a magical object or as a magical set of prayers that is of itself going to have some magical virtue. This is not a magic situation. This is an interpersonal situation. Asking Mary to pray for your intentions is a good thing. Using the Marian Rosary is a traditional way to do that. It's one that has a prominent place in the history of Latin spirituality. It's not actually universal in the Catholic Church. The Eastern Catholic Churches, many of them don't have the Marian Rosary. They have other devotions involving Mary, like, for example, some of them use a hymn known as the Akathist Hymn. As their form of Marian devotion. So the rosary is not universal. And sometimes, because it is so common here in the Latin Church, people tend to assume that, oh, this is just an essential element of Catholicism, when actually it's not. It's not even used by all Catholics. Other Catholics have other forms of devotion. This is a prominent form of devotion, and it's a good one to use. But we shouldn't think of it as if it's magic, or if you say the rosary, it's going to compel Mary or compel God to answer your intention in a particular way.
Pilgrim, thank you very much. Appreciate the question. Up next, let me see that. Koalam 888 asks this. Why can't Catholicism be just another denomination among the denominations? I think Protestants see Catholicism as a Christian denomination, thus no need to make the move if they are already happy where they are.
Okay. If I were just hearing that, the question that Harlam asked, you know, why can't Catholicism be just another denomination among the denominations? My first response would be to say, well, who says it's not? Now, I know there are Catholics who say things like the Catholic Church is not a denomination, it's the original church. Well, it's true, it's the original church, but they're using a particular understanding of the word denomination that is not universally shared. The term denomination comes from the Latin word nomen, which just means name. And so a denomination is anything you can apply a name to, based on its etymology. And in a Christian context, it's come to refer to different groups of Christians that share a common name. And so, Sykelet, do Catholics share a common name?
Catholic?
Yeah. Okay. Uh-huh.
I knew I could get that one.
You even find church documents using it.
Yeah.
And if you read things like the Catechism, and if you read other official church documents, it's really hard to find anything stated that the Catholic Church is not a denomination. This seems to be an idea that's popular in some circles, but it seems to be a folk belief rather than a church teaching. So my first thought would be, well, who says it's not? Catholics have a common name, namely Catholic. So if you want to conceptualize them as a denomination, you can. That doesn't mean, though, that they're just the same as any other denomination. And this gets into the second statement that Koalam makes, where he says, I think Protestants see Catholics as a Christian denomination, meaning an ordinary Christian denomination, and thus no need to make the move if they are already happy where they are. And I would agree, a lot of them do see that. And that is where they go wrong. It's not that the Catholic Church doesn't have a common name and thus can't be considered a denomination in that sense. It's that it's not the same as other denominations. It's the original Church of Jesus. You know, Jesus told St. Peter, on this rock I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. That means that Jesus's church has been in existence since the first century, because it's never died. That's what the gates of hell will not prevail against it means, is it's never going to die. So Jesus built his church back in the first century, and it continues today. And thus, and there is no idea in the New Testament of an invisible church of all true believers. The church is always understood as a communion that has identifiable members and laws. That's what the power of binding and loosing is about, and various other factors that indicate it's what's called a visible church. So if you want to be part of Jesus's church, or if you just want to honor the will of Jesus, you want to be part of his church, and that means finding the visible communion of Christians that has existed since the first century, and that's the Catholic Church. And there are also other benefits to being part of his church, like it has this, it has all of the seven sacraments, it has the Pope, it has a hierarchy of bishops guiding it, being guided by the Holy Spirit. So there are a bunch of advantages. And thus, I would say, even if you want to conceptualize the Catholic Church as a denomination, it's not just an ordinary denomination. And if you want to honor the will of Jesus, who created the church for your benefit, then you need to join his actual church, which is the Catholic Church.
Kualam, thank you very much for the question. Got to take a quick break. Right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Isn't it awesome that we today do not recognize his presence in the Eucharist? Is it because we really don't go to him in humbleness of heart and say, Lord, I don't believe, help my unbelief. Lord, I want to see you. I want to recognize you. I cannot live without you. Are we saying that?
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and I don't want to say infinite, but it seems near infinite. It gives the impression of an infinite number of questions from the internet, so lots of those to get through. Never a shortage of them. That's probably the way I should have said it. This one comes from Jordan Matteoli, 6354. Jordan wants to know this. If priests have the sacramental power to ordain, why has this actually happened so rarely in church history?
Okay, so people may not be familiar with this, but it is actually an open question whether priests have the ability to ordain other priests. It's a bishop who ordains priests, and that's for reasons I'll get into. But there have been a few situations in history where popes have authorized people who are only priests to ordain other priests. Like if you have an abbot in his abbey and you know the local bishop is distant or something like that, popes have authorized, like, okay, you, Mr. Abbot, even though you're only a priest, you can ordain new priests in your monastery. And there have been cases where popes have authorized that, but it's not a huge number. And I would say that the reason it happens so rarely is twofold. The first part of the reason is, well, bishops clearly have the fullness of the sacrament of orders. And just even though the situation is analogous to baptism. So Even though anybody can baptize an unbaptized person, there's an appropriateness to have a holy person like a priest baptize an unbaptized person. And so even though it's not required, it's still appropriate to have someone who's in holy orders, like a bishop, a priest, or a deacon, do the baptism. And so that's the law that the church has instituted, that apart from exceptional circumstances, it ought to be a bishop, priest, or deacon doing the baptism, even though it's not required. It's just more appropriate. And the same thing, since bishops are the leaders of the local church, and since priests are going to be responsible to report to the local bishop, it makes sense for the bishop to do the ordination. It's not necessarily required, as the abbot situation I illustrated indicates, but even if it's possible for priests to ordain other priests, it's appropriate that this be done by the bishop, because he's the one they're reporting to, and he's the highest person in the local church, and it just makes sense to have the second highest people in the church ordained by the highest person in the local church. So there's an appropriateness reason here. There's also, I would say, a second reason, which is it ain't certain that priests have the ability to do this. The Pope has authorized it on occasion, but the church has not taught that priests have the ability to do this. And, you know, doctrinal development has progressed over time, and there hasn't been one of these cases in centuries. So you could argue that the Holy Spirit is leading the church in the direction of saying only bishops can do this. And if that's the case, and I would say today there it is an open question about whether priests can do it. And if it's an open question, well, better safe than sorry. We know bishops can do it. We are not certain that priests can do it. And therefore, on the principle of failing safe, let's just have the bishops do it, because we know they can. So it's safer to have the bishops do it than to authorize priests to do it.
Jordan, thank you very much for that question. This one comes from Collins 12246. Collins says, why is it mandatory to go to a priest for confession before one can go to Holy Communion? Why isn't going to God directly sufficient for this? If someone sits on his seat because he hasn't gone for confession, everyone would see that he hasn't gone to confession. It would elicit some kind of shame on that person.
Okay, so let me address the second part first about if you stay in your seat for communion, does that tell everyone that you have an unconfessed mortal sin? Well, no, it doesn't. There could be any number of reasons that you're not going forward for communion. Among them, you may have eaten or drunk something and broken the Eucharistic fast. And so, you know, there's no sin in that. It just means you're not eligible to go to communion right now. Or there could be some other reason, you know, a matter of personal spirituality of, you know, it'll foster your devotion to Christ if you have a Eucharistic fast for a time, so you're not going to receive right now. And you don't know what's going on in other people's lives. So we should never assume that someone who remains back and doesn't receive communion is in a state of unconfessed mortal sin. That's just a bad assumption. And therefore, you know, you shouldn't put that burden on yourself of thinking that, oh, everyone's going to assume this about me if I don't go and receive communion. They shouldn't. Now, some of them may, but, well, that's part of the price of having unconfessed mortal sin, is you don't get to go. In terms of the foundational issue of why is it mandatory, well, Jesus told the disciples in John 20 that whoever sins they are forgiven, they are forgiven. Whoever sins you retain, they are retained. So he commissioned his ministers to either forgive or retain sins. And that means, since they don't know whether they need to forgive or retain the sin, they need to, you know, they're not that telepathic. They need to be told about the sin, and they need to be told about whether you're repentant of it or not. So they have a basis to either forgive or retain. So that presupposes that Christians are going to go to them for confession. But Saikelet, is it practical for Christians to go to confession for every little tiny sin they commit during the course of the day, or what are known as venial sins? Would that be practical?
No, no way.
No. So the church has recognized that some sins don't need to be confessed because it simply wouldn't be practical. On the other hand, Cy Kellett, if we say, okay, Jesus wanted his ministers to forgive or retain sins, but it's not necessary to go to them for tiny little peccadilloes that we would classify as venial, what does that tell us about which sins need to be confessed to them? Which kind is it going to be?
The big ones.
The big ones, yeah, the mortal sins. So as just a matter of theological reflection that eventually became doctrine, the Holy Spirit led the church to recognize that in order to honor the will of Christ here, we need to confess mortal sins to priests, but we don't need to confess venial ones. So that's the fundamental reason. So that's the reason for the general principle. Collins then says, why isn't going directly to God sufficient for this? Well, because we want to fulfill the will of Christ. And the will of Christ is that we confess our mortal sins sacramentally before we go to communion. Now, that doesn't mean it's absolutely necessary to do that. There are situations in which one may go to communion without going to confession first, and the conditions specified for that are in Canon 916 of the Code of Canon Law. Because it is possible for someone to be reconciled with God even before they go to confession, you know, if they make an act of perfect contrition, which is a rejection of sin based on love of God, then they're reconciled with God even before they go to confession. It's still Christ's will that they go to confession, so you still need to go, but you're already reconciled with God and in a state of grace even before you go to confession. So let's suppose that's happened with you. Could you then, in principle, receive communion? In principle, the answer is yes, because you're in a state of grace, and that's the fundamental requirement to receive communion, is being in a state of grace. But because many people would deceive themselves and fudge it, the church has and say, oh, I think I'm in a state of grace, when really they're not. The church has a practical law saying don't go to communion if you have unconfessed mortal sin unless the following conditions are met. So this is Canon 916. It says, a person who is conscious of grave sin is not to celebrate Mass or receive the body of the Lord, so that's going to communion, without previous sacramental confession, unless there is a grave reason and there is no opportunity to confess. In this case, the person is to remember the obligation to make an act of perfect contrition that includes the resolution of confessing as soon as possible. So those are the two conditions that need to be met in order to receive communion without prior sacramental confession. There needs to be a grave reason, meaning something serious, not just a personal preference or a desire to avoid embarrassment, but a grave reason and no opportunity to confess. Now, that can apply in a variety of situations. One that I imagine it gets applied in a lot is when a parish priest who needs to say a Mass has committed a mortal sin and repented, and there's no other priest around to hear his confession in a timely manner, but he needs to say the scheduled Mass. So in that case, there's a grave reason. He needs to say the Mass, and since there's no other priest around to hear his confession, the condition of not having the opportunity to confess is fulfilled. And so in this case, he needs to remember the obligation to make an act of perfect contrition, including the resolution to go confess as soon as possible. The same thing can happen with lay people. Danger of death is obviously a grave situation. There are others, but it is in principle possible for a lay person to receive communion without prior sacramental confession if they make an act of perfect contrition intended to receive sacramental confession as soon as they're able. But there needs to be a grave reason, and there needs to be no present opportunity for them to confess. And the fundamental reason why all that is because we want to honor Jesus's will by going to his ministers for absolution, if at all possible.
Collins, thank you very much. About a million more questions to get to, so we'll do this again with Jimmy. These internet open forums are always fun. I enjoy them anyways. And we also get to hear from people who probably can't, because of their schedule or for their geographic location, just pick up the phone and call us during the show. So that's another benefit of these. Thanks to everybody who submitted their questions. Thanks to you, Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. I always enjoy the hours with you.
My pleasure.
That will do it for us. What is going on? All right, we'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.